Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. He joins us to discuss the Senate Intelligence Committee report on the CIA's use of torture and rendition. In particular, revelations in the report that the Bush White House went out of their way to keep Colonel Wilkerson's boss, Colin Powell, in the dark, when the Bush-Cheney administration abandoned the moral high ground as they embraced the dark side in response to the 9/11 attacks. We will also look into the extent to which Vice President Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice should be held responsible for the torture regime that they championed, directed, and managed, along with elements within the CIA who followed their orders. Then we'll assess the press conference today by the CIA Director John Brennan, who defended the agency's post-9/11 interrogation methods that he admitted were harsh and abhorrent, but when pressed to provide evidence that torture had obtained useful information, offered the following. Quoting, "The cause and effect relationship between the use of EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques, and useful information subsequently provided by detainees is, in my view, unknowable." Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss Brennan's less than robust defense of the CIA and Scott Horton's new book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security State and America's Stealth Warfare. Then finally, we'll examine the other torture report, the National Truth Commission report presented by Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff at a ceremony in Brasilia, at which she broke down in tears, having been a victim herself of torture by the military regime that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, joins us to discuss the report and the burgeoning corruption scandal engulfing the national oil company Petrobras that threatens Rousseff's government. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And given that you, in effect, were the first to go public and alert the American people as to the activities of the Bush administration, how do you feel about this report finally coming out now? Do you think, in the context of truth and reconciliation, that we are going to have the moment that we clearly need as a nation?
You've asked me for two answers. First, yes, I'm glad that it finally, after such a, if I can use this word, torturous progress, made its way out into the public arena. But the second part of your question was, will there be any impact? And other than airing our dirty laundry for the world to see, I doubt there will be very much, because accountability at the level where it should be achieved is, I think, impossible in our country today.
But is that the accountability where, for the longest time, presidents have essentially used the CIA as the favorite toy of the executive branch, and the CIA always gets blamed for essentially what they've been ordered to do by prior presidents?
Well, I think I teach this, and I've looked, and my students have looked, over 300 students now, at issues just like what you just described. From the 1947 National Security Act, which of course created the Central Intelligence Agency, to the present time. And I will tell you that blame goes both ways. There has been massive abuse of power, as there almost always will be. Check James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington. When you exercise massive power in secret, there will almost always be abuses of that power when you do it in secret. And the abuses will come from the instrument of that power, in this case the CIA, as well as from those policymakers who lead it into the dark, so to speak. So there, from the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 to this present situation, there is blame to go on both sides, both the policymakers, the decision makers, and the instrument, the CIA.
But in terms of your being the Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, we've spoken in the past about the number of days, the long days that you spent on the seventh floor conference room at the top, at the executive level of the CIA, while preparing for Colin Powell's fateful address to the United Nations, which is in a sense was to the world, where he very effectively sold the Iraq war based on intelligence that he was very dubious about. It's hard not to come to the conclusion that Colin Powell was used by the White House, and at the same time, they turned around and kept him in the dark about what they were really doing, having used him to sell the war. Then they kept what they were doing secret from him. Is that a correct understanding?
Well, again, my study of presidents from World War II on has indicated that this isn't an exception, except perhaps in the dramatic way it was done in this administration, and certainly in the way it was done by a previously insignificant, really, position in the U.S. government, the vice president. I will never stop laying the blame for the majority of this criminal and otherwise activity at the feet of Dick Cheney. He was the ultimate person responsible. So it's not something unique, except in the nature and the drama and the profundity of the crimes executed, if you will. I think it's unique also, and I've pointed this out before, that for the first time in what I conceive as post-World War II history, but I think probably in American history, torture, which has happened before. It happened in the Philippines at the turn of the last century. It happened in Vietnam under the Phoenix Program. Torture was always something that happened down at the level of the execution. That is to say, it was, as Donald Rumsfeld opined earlier about this situation, it was bad apples. It was people who went too far at the bottom level of the decision cycle. In this case, the uniqueness of this situation is that torture, breaking the law, and let's be very clear about that, even if you believe torture has some efficacy, you can't object to the fact, you simply can't object to the fact that it isn't breaking the law. It broke international law, the UN Convention, and it broke domestic law, which when we signed the convention had to be made to conform. So it broke both international law and domestic law. It was, in a word, illegal. They broke the law. And this was authorized, this breaking of the law was authorized at the highest levels in the land. That, in my experience, has never happened before.
So in the report, Lawrence Wilkerson, again, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, in 2005 he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Now, the Senate to Select Intelligence Committee report makes it very clear that the White House went out of their way to keep your boss Colin Powell in the dark. But in a curious way, the fact that you mentioned the normally insignificant role of the vice president in effect became the shadow president in the Bush administration. Vice President Cheney had his own National Security Council. In many ways, I think he kept even the president out of the loop on a number of occasions, and eventually because of Ashcroft's illness and trying to extend that secret regime, I think the president finally found out just before the elections against John Kerry the extent to which he had in fact been kept out of the loop about what was really happening. I believe they're estranged to this day. So am I correct in suggesting that Colin Powell wasn't the only person who was kept in the dark by Dick Cheney?
Well, I have no way of knowing that positively. I was not in the Oval Office during the conversations between the vice president and the president, of course. And I say that pointedly because often that was the way it happened. There was no one in the office. Dick Cheney, as Richard Haass said one time, actually always got the last bite at the apple. And oftentimes the president would make a decision in the statutory process, that is to say, before the National Security Council or before the Principals Committee. And then later, when Cheney learned of that decision because of his absence, fly fishing in Wyoming or whatever, Cheney would get to the president alone and get the president to change that decision, sometimes in the middle of things. I can't say that I know positively what happened in the Oval Office, but my deep and abiding suspicion is that Dick Cheney did things that the president didn't even know about, both domestic things, as Bart Gellman points out in his book, Angler, with regard to the taxes that were cut so markedly. Three particular sections of the tax cut were advocated by Cheney, only two by Bush. Cheney went over and lobbied the Congress and got the Congress to present a president who was not very prone to veto, got the president to sign a bill that had the two he wanted in it, but also the third that he didn't want because Dick Cheney did want it. So Cheney manipulated this president during the first term. There's no question in my mind that he did.
I think maybe that explained. I think Bush actually went public about, didn't he, or said something about, you know, why are we doing this? But he nevertheless signed it.
Well, in this particular case, Cheney had been very adept.
Right. I remember that.
He was an extraordinary bureaucrat. No vice president, in my knowledge, has ever gone over and made himself a force in the Congress the way Dick Cheney did. One ought to look at that from a constitutional perspective, too.
Well, but together with Rumsfeld, his former boss, those two tag-teaming, they are the two of the best political infighters probably the U.S. bureaucracy has ever produced.
Utterly ruthless. Utterly ruthless, adept at what they were doing, had a strategy, and were, as I said, utterly ruthless in executing it. They beat the socks off of us.
And when this report mentions Condoleezza Rice a lot, as her name is woven through it, as though she is more than anybody being held responsible, would you hold her responsible, or was she just the cog in the wheel?
I think there's some responsibility there, but I think it's more in the guise of a lack of action. I think Dr. Rice found herself against that tandem of Rumsfeld and Cheney, Rumsfeld absolutely demeaning her, absolutely incapable of accomplishing the discipline that she should have accomplished as National Security Advisor. And when I say discipline, I mean controlling and managing the decision-making process so the president wasn't hurt by it. I think she failed in that, but she failed in that because of the foes she was up against. When you put two statutory members of the National Security Council, Vice President and Secretary of Defense, together against the National Security Advisor, whom we must remember is not even a person in the 47 Act, not even a position subject to the advising consent of the Senate. It is a position that was created out of whole cloth. It wasn't even contemplated by the framers of the Act. So they're powerful only in the sense that the president gives them power. And so in order to stay close to the president and to have his power, and also to get her job, Secretary of State, later, she had to sort of subdue her ability to control the other two members. Otherwise, they probably would have done some damage to her chances.
Well, but she didn't make a natural ally out of Colin Powell, did she?
She didn't, and that will always be a mystery to me. I mean, she was somewhat a protege of his and of Brent Scowcroft, who we know finally went public about his opposition to some of the things that George Bush's administration was doing. So it didn't make any sense from the perspective of where Condi had come from and the beliefs that she espoused, which were more or less realist conservative beliefs. She went along with some things that were anything but realist conservative beliefs. They were radical beliefs. They were breaking the law beliefs.
And she ended up with Colin Powell's job.
Yes.
So what explains the fact that Donald Rumsfeld didn't want, he kept the DOD out of this torture regime. He wanted nothing to do with it. That's pretty much what the report makes clear.
Well, that's not what happened, though.
Okay.
If you look at it closely, Donald Rumsfeld had the usual bureaucratic distrust of the CIA and the usual bureaucratic anxiety about getting good intelligence and getting it fast. So you had two channels for this to take place, actually, for torture to take place, EIT to take place, be implemented. You had the channel that was the CIA that's been so vividly revealed now, and probably was the most heinous and nefarious because it was totally in secret. And then you had the channel that ran through Donald Rumsfeld and his general counsel, Bill Haynes, and Douglas Feith as Undersecretary for Policy, who were complicit with David Addington in the Vice President's office, both in framing the legal background, the weird legal background for the torture, and in actually executing it, who pushed this policy down through military channels, not only to Bagram in Afghanistan, but to Abu Ghraib and elsewhere in Iraq, and also, most profoundly, to Guantanamo.
So how was he escaping the condemnation? That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's extraordinary. And that's really what got me energized, because including the armed forces in this business was a total mistake. It was a complete and utter mistake. When you take a lieutenant on the battlefield who's got so many problems already on his plate, and you give him this additional problem of, by policy, or authorizing his soldiers to do things that they shouldn't be doing, you've just opened Pandora's box for that lieutenant.
Well, not to mention for the reciprocity of any American soldier who's captured.
True, absolutely true. And, of course, that was one of Powell's gravest concerns when he mounted his arguments, along with Will Taft, his lawyer, against the idea that we would abandon the Geneva Conventions.
So we have a very strange situation at the moment, Colonel Wilkinson, where the President of the United States is actually telling Nancy Pelosi and the Congress that they should accept this terrible deal just to get the government funded, which will allow essentially the people who brought about the 2008 crash on Wall Street to use the FDIC to cover their bets in derivatives and swaps, which were the reason why the economy crashed. And there are various other mendacious things in the bill, which the Democrats are trying to stop. But the White House is saying, go ahead and take the vote. And the same thing seems to be happening with the CIA and with Brennan. The president seems to have decided he's better off throwing his lot in with the CIA and Brennan than he is with the torture report. He's straddling, shall we say.
As I said earlier, I didn't think there would be a whole lot of accountability. I go back to JFK, when JFK, the last president to truly stand up to the military-industrial complex, to the Pentagon, to the military leaders who were advising him not to stop the failed invasion at the Bay of Pigs, but to continue, and to continue with U.S. air power, and if necessary, with a U.S. invasion, formal U.S. invasion of Cuba, he stood up to them. And then again, he stood up to them in October when we were dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's the last president, for whatever reason. I won't go into the reasons I think Kennedy and his brother Bobby did this, but they were the last to stand up to the agency. He actually fired Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA at the time. They were the last people to stand up to the CIA and to the complex. And you saw what happened to Kennedy.
Well, on that note, Colonel Wilkinson, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkinson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and a former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security State and America's Stealth Warfare.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who is a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. His latest book just out is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And what did you make, Scott, of the CIA director's, John Brennan's, defense of the agency's post-9/11 interrogation methods at an extraordinary press conference held today by the CIA? What was your impression of how John Brennan handled this roiling crisis, if you will?
I would say it was a remarkably shaky and weak performance by Brennan. He started out in predictable form talking about 9/11 over and over again, talking about lives being saved by the CIA. Looked like he was trying to defend the institution of the CIA itself from being disestablished. He had very, very little to say about the specific allegations of the report. I think what was truly amazing about this performance, however, was that Senator Dianne Feinstein live tweeted a rejoinder to it all the way through his presentation. And if you look at her posts and his statements, there's absolutely no question who had the upper hand all through his talk, and that was DFI.
Well, what I found extraordinary about his defense of this euphemism they used, EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques, was on the one hand that he admitted that the techniques were harsh and abhorrent, but then when he was pressed to provide evidence that torture had obtained useful information, he offered up this extraordinary statement. The cause and effect relationship between the use of EITs and useful information subsequently provided by detainees is, in my view, unknowable.
I think that's a completely ridiculous statement, of course, because they've just spent 5 years studying the cause and effect relationship, and the agency was not able to produce any evidence to support its claims that, in fact, actionable intelligence had been gained from the use of the EITs, or torture. I think actually we've seen a pretty dramatic shift globally in journalistic coverage of this issue in the last 48 hours, so that now newspapers and broadcasters around the world simply say torture, not EIT. EIT is being used only by John Brennan and other former CIA figures, and of course, Dick Cheney. But, you know, the locution he used constantly was that individuals who were subjected to EITs provided useful information, and there's never been any doubt about that. The question, of course, was whether or not that information flowed from the EITs, and that's where they've had a complete failure of evidence to support their claims. Because what we see in many cases is that good evidence was furnished by these individuals before they were subjected to the EITs, but not after.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. His latest book just out is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And Scott, in terms of the book, I must say that the timing is very good. I know it comes out in January, but I was just looking at before I came on the air with a clip from that news show Vice of the fellow who's at the center of this scandal coming out of the Senate report, and that is the fact that these two Air Force psychologists were paid $81 million plus a whole bunch more to indemnify them. And it's extraordinary. And I looked at this video of one of them, the main guy, and it really sort of, it's the banality of evil. It really is.
I think that's right. I mean, that's James Elmer Mitchell.
That's right, yes.
Gave that interview to Vice. And in fact, he has been speaking off the record with a number of journalists over the last couple of months, has not up until this point agreed to allow people to go forward with what he said. But I think most people who've dealt with him and have interviewed him walk away shaking their heads that, you know, this is a remarkably frivolous and hollow person to have played such an incredibly focal role here. I mean, to have landed the $180 million contract, that was the value of the contract, $80 million actually paid on it, and he's someone who had no experience in interrogations, knew nothing about political Islamists or anything else. He was selected basically because he was willing to train people in torture techniques. And I think more responsible, more ethically conscious psychologists refused to have anything to do with it. So I think what you saw was the CIA reaching to the bottom of the pile. And you know, we interestingly saw the APA, the American Psychological Association, immediately after these interviews, putting out statements saying neither of these two individuals are currently members of the APA, and therefore they have no power or authority to discipline them for obviously improper conduct.
Well, yeah, you mean first do no harm? Right. Well, I was stunned by the very same thing that you just pointed out, Scott Horton. This is the guy that got $81 million of taxpayer money. Unbelievable. Where do you sign up for jobs like that?
Well, and I'll tell you another angle of that, which has not yet fully come out, but it's redacted in this report. But I can unredact it for you, because I can tell you that the $1.1 million that was paid to a prominent law firm was paid to the firm of Wilmer Hale, and particularly to Jamie Gorelick, a partner at that firm, prominent
liberal
senior Justice Department official in prior administrations, and she was paid that more than $1 million essentially to lobby on behalf of the CIA with Congress. Totally outrageous, totally ridiculous.
And this is against the law, I think, isn't it? Government agencies aren't.
Absolutely. I mean, there are two tiers of law here. There's the Magnuson Act, which basically prevents propagandizing by the defense and intelligence establishment domestically. But then there's also specific legislation that was passed in 2007 that forbade the government from spending any appropriated funds to lobby on behalf of torture. And that's exactly what was going on.
So in terms of the thrust of your book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, I guess that, you know, one always has, doesn't have to, but I always feel like, you know, going back to Ben Franklin's famous warning that he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. And it seems like, you know, we have the military industrial complex, we have the terrorism industrial complex, now we have the torture industrial complex. I mean, how do you extricate money and greed from policy and results?
Well, I think the question here ultimately is a question of accountability within the framework of a democratic society. And, you know, democracies always have a difficult time dealing with intelligence agencies because they're secret, because so few people have the ability to look at their budgets, because they engage in activities that are kept out of the public eye. So that raises questions. And I think what we see now is the sort of the dark side spreading quite dramatically. And during his talk, Brennan said, "We at the CIA speak truth to power." That was a completely outrageous statement. In fact, it's exactly the other way around. I mean, to me, it's completely unbelievable that you could have a government agency like this CIA, which becomes involved in torturing innocent people, as we discovered, more than 2,000 people completely innocent who are tortured, murdering people, all this occurring with no form of accountability whatsoever, no meaningful investigation actually transpiring by the Justice Department. That's another thing that I think is coming through now very, very clearly. It's a government that manipulates the media. We saw a tremendous amount of information about that in this report. It launches elaborate public relations campaigns. It attacks members of the Senate and the Senate committee. It tries to subvert their investigation. All of that is clearly inconsistent with the law and the constitutional order of the United States, and yet we see they get away with it. There's no accountability for it. And I think right now, the big question is going to be, can John Brennan hold on as director of this agency? And can this small coterie of individuals who were involved in this torture program, who now sit at high positions in the agency, can they hold on to their positions? Because we're hearing more and more calls, including on the floor of the Senate, for them all to be removed, for the Ogeon stables of the CIA to be swept clean.
And that's what Mark Udall was saying on the floor of the Senate yesterday. You know, how could these guys not only do what they did, but get promoted? And Udall also went on to talk about the CIA's own report into torture, which is apparently almost identical to the Senate report. And that was the reason why the CIA spied on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, because they wanted to know who'd leaked the internal CIA report, the so-called Panetta report. That's why they spied on the Senate. And today in the press conference, John Brennan was asked about that report, because if you release that CIA report, then all of these right-wing defenders of torture would be absolutely eviscerated, because the CIA came to the same conclusions that the Senate did. Ben, of course, what did you think of Brennan's answer to that?
And he gave the most petty, niggling, lawyerly answer, saying...
Hello, did we lose you?
Original request that came from Dianne Feinstein, and therefore they weren't going to release it. That's absurd. The Congress has a right to request any documents from the CIA, and certainly with the report itself being published and the CIA denying the report but having its own internal review saying that the report is correct and accepting its findings, that document, that Panetta report, needs to be public.
So what do you think the chances are? I mean, it doesn't seem like the president, he's trying to straddle this one, but he's certainly not pushing the CIA in any way, from what I can tell.
He's not at all, but I think that we're going to see the publication of that report soon, because I think there are a lot of people who like to get it out there. And by the way, just another very important point that Dianne Feinstein made today, Brennan stood up and he said he was speaking on behalf of the CIA and the men and women who serve there, and that's not true. I think one thing Feinstein made very, very clear is a large part of that agency wants to purge the stain of torture and be done with it, and wants to come clean. And, you know, I myself have interviewed a significant number of acting senior CIA figures who feel exactly that way. They do not agree with John Brennan. They certainly don't agree with Michael Hayden. They want to see the stain swept away from the CIA.
And presumably these are the people that have some talent and some conscience compared to the character that I was telling you about, who came up with this, got $81 million for devising this program. You just wonder how those people ever get rewarded and how they ever get into the government in the first place. It's extraordinary to think that people like that and like Jose Rodriguez have been promoted as a result of these appalling activities.
Exactly right. And we know from the CIA's own internal investigation, again, there are more than 120 CIA agents who protested the use of torture and told the inspector general they did not believe this is legal and that it could possibly be authorized or used by the CIA. That's more people than were actually involved in the program.
And again, we've been speaking with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. His latest book, Just Out, is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the other torture report, the National Truth Commission's report presented by Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paulo Sotero, who's the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France International. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paulo Sotero.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Ian.
And Paulo, the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, who herself was a political prisoner who was tortured by the military regime during the time they ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985, in presenting the National Truth Commission report at a ceremony in Brasilia on Wednesday, she broke down in tears. It was a very powerful moment.
It was indeed, and people recognized her and joined her sort of in applause, in solidarity, because everybody in Brazil knows that what she went through when she was a young militant of a leftist group in Brazil really was of the people most brutally tortured in that period. She, as president, was the first one to have sort of the courage to call for this, the creation of this truth commission in Brazil with limited powers, but she provided the resources, and the truth commission worked for about a year and a half, produced this report. We knew from the start that it would have a limited impact because the basic law that allowed Brazil to go back from military regime to a democracy in the year of 1985 was an amnesty law that also covered those that have practiced it, could have been charged of human rights abuses or like the torturers of Dilma Rousseff. And this was the compromise that was accepted at the time by the principal main parties of the opposition, and that remains the case. They cannot be prosecuted for the crimes they have committed under the dictatorship, especially for torture or for being involved into the disappearance of you know, of people.
Well, the report indicates that there's more people were killed or disappeared during the dictatorship. Originally, the official number was 362. Now it's 434. It also named 377 people it said were involved in human rights abuses, of whom 196 are still alive today. So, and it also went on to say that those who committed serious human rights abuses should face criminal prosecution. So how is that going to happen because of the 1979 amnesty law?
I am afraid that it's not going to happen. What the members of the commission recommended was that they be prosecuted, and they used the concept of crimes against humanity that were adopted and inscribed in international conventions, of which Brazil is a signatory, but after the amnesty law. In 2010, the Supreme Court of Brazil was asked to reinterpret the 79 amnesty law in a way that would allow Brazil to prosecute those that committed those crimes. The Supreme Court of Brazil, 2010, nominated then mostly by presidents committed to the democratic project, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, they decided to affirm the interpretation that the 79 law covers or gives amnesty to those that perpetrated crimes related to the human rights abuses, which means those who tortured, who abused people, etc. Now, the case will be revisited by the Supreme Court again in a few months, and this will continue to happen. There are, in certain cases, Ian, there are new openings. For instance, there is an interpretation that crimes that involve people that disappeared were never found. Since you don't have the remains of those people, the crime is continuing. And under that concept, since the crime continues, it's not covered by the amnesty. So there are attempts to move and to prosecute cases like that. There are about 10 people that are being that have been charged by federal prosecutors in Brazil. Those cases are going through the courts, but they will obviously be challenged in the Supreme Court if they come to a condemnation of the people that were charged.
And again, I'm speaking with Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School for International Affairs at George Washington University. So in terms of the people who've disappeared and whose bodies have never been located, there are apparently 210 people in this listed as in that category in this report. So presumably this could go on for some time. I mean, what I find so striking is that you contrast the National Truth Commission in Brazil with a national ceremony involving the president herself presenting the report to the country, compared to what's going on in this country, where you know, today we had the CIA director fielding questions. I think the striking difference is that in Brazil, they really are trying to do something about it. Here, you get the feeling this is a political inconvenience to a lot of people, and they wish it would go away. How are the Brazilian people responding?
Well, you know, I think that most in Brazil, I think, would understand that those things happen in Brazil. But the value of the Truth Commission is to remind people, as we prepare to celebrate 30 years of democracy in Brazil, that we still have that case open. We have to face this because, as the president of the commission, the Truth Commission said, we don't face this. We will revisit the situation. You know, torture is not something that has obviously disappeared in Brazil. Torture against common people that commit the common crimes are still present, especially in the interior of the country. But you have the idea here, Ian, is to continue to put pressure to mobilize society in order to end impunity in Brazil. This is the issue. Obviously, the fact that, a country that advocates human rights as a policy like the United States is now facing its own demons in that area, and that has resorted to abusive practices, torture in the combating terrorism, obviously, is people are paying attention to that, and those are two democracies facing realities that are very adverse to the rule of law, let's say, and it is will continue to be challenging to both societies. I believe in Brazil, this is probably, I'm being a little bit cynical here, is that, there are 197 of the people that the commission said should be prosecuted. They are all in their 70s, most of them, or 80s. These people will not be, or most of them will not be with us in about 10 years, and probably this is how it's going to, over time, be processed, but again, the militants, politicians, lawyers, legal scholars in Brazil will continue to put pressure for prosecution, that Brazil revisits this very sad past and continues to advance in containing and ending impunity in Brazil, which is a major problem in the country.
But the Paulo Sotero, the fact that in the United States supported the coup in 1964, the military coup that brought about these atrocities and ruled the country until 1985, is that in any way the residual source of anti-Americanism? How do the Brazilian people feel about the United States since they supported this coup back in 1964?
Well, obviously, those on the left have always been very suspicious of the United States, know about the United States' involvement in supporting the coup, but it's different, mind you, of what the United States did in Chile, for instance, in 73. There was a direct participation of the United States in the conspiracy. In this case, the coup was made in Brazil by Brazilians, and the United States decided in the context of the Cold War that it was in its national interest to side with the dictators. I think there was a calculation at that time that would be a very short interruption of the rule of law, that Brazil would go back to democracy in the year of 65, and then obviously the people that executed the coup, as always happens in those situations, lost control of the process. It took Brazil 21 years to go back to democracy, and Brazil faced all of the problems that we are still dealing with, that led to the creation of the Truth Commission. Now, it's very easy also, would be very easy in Brazil say that, all this happens in Brazil because of the United States. And that is absolutely not true. Most Brazilians know, most well-informed Brazilians know that this happens in Brazil because Brazilians did it. Brazil is a country that is still, in the process of building its own institutions. We are facing now, for instance, a major, major corruption scandal. Nobody did it, helped Brazil, become as corrupt as our institute we have become in managing public companies in Brazil and construction companies in Brazil. Those are part of a tradition of corruption in Brazil, in a patrimonial society that has to still democratize further and open up and establish rules of due process of governance in companies, etc. Same here, you know, these were atrocities committed in Brazil by Brazilians. It is said that sectors of U.S. society at some point saw that it was in the best interest of the United States to be associated with those practices, but at the same time, especially starting with President Carter, there was a clear separation, you know, between U.S. distancing of U.S. policy and those abuses, and there are people, Americans, that are part of the struggle against the military regime in Brazil. And they are honored, they are remembered in Brazil.
So, Paulo Cetera, clearly it would seem to me that the history of the military government and the brutality towards Brazilian citizens, and particularly those activists on the left, seems to have translated in the politics of the country since 1985. You basically don't have any right-wing parties, do you? It seems to be mostly left-wing parties. So does the right wing in Brazil have very little support because of the memories of the right wing coup and the military government?
We have some. I think right now 38 political parties in Brazil. 28 of them represented in the next Congress. All of them are very, very conservative by any standards of any country. So we do have, what we have had are there two prominent parties, the Socialist Party, the Workers' Party of Brazil, the party of President Lula, part of President Dilma Rousseff, that has been progressive in its evolution, the Social Democratic Party of President Cardoso. They have dominated the presidential scene in the past 20 to 25 years, but it doesn't mean that, you know, the leftist parties in Brazil, also the main partner of the Workers' Party, the PMDB. PMDB and the Workers' Party are precisely the two parties that are now being accused of involvement in the most important, the biggest case of corruption in Brazil involving a state company, Petrobras. This is the tradition in Brazil. Corruption has always been there when the right wing was in power, when the conservatives were in power, and we see now that has not really changed. We have the Workers' Party that came from grassroots efforts in Brazil. It's the only political power party in Brazil that has that type of history. Was for many years identified as a party fighting for the people with ethical principles, etc. And once the Workers' Party came to federal power, it adopted all the bad habits of the traditional parties, what you would call the conservative, the right-wing party. So it is sad because it shows that we have to, you know, the struggle to build a democracy is a long, very long march, and you have to continue to believe that it's possible to build a society based on the rule of law. I would not automatically identify in Brazil, the left party as the purer party in Brazil. I know very honorable politicians of different political inclinations in Brazil. The fact is that we are dealing right now, President Dilma Rousseff is dealing right now with a humongous case of corruption whose consequence we don't know yet. It could be huge. And in the public's mind, this is the case that is of concern right now, much more, frankly, than what happened in terms of human rights abuses during the military dictatorship from 64 to 85. I'm not saying that to try to say that it's not serious. No, it was very serious, and it should be prosecuted. But the division of Brazil, like between right wing and left wing, and attributing all the virtues to the left and all the sins to the right, this clearly does not apply, and I think that you would have a very difficult time convince Brazilian society that we should think, imagine the world that way. It's a more complicated picture, and we are seeing it right now in this horrible case of corruption that we have to deal with.
Well, just in the last minute, Paulo Sotero, to give us an idea of the scope of the Petrobras scandal and the corruption and how it's impacting the ruling government, would it be similar to like Pemex in Mexico, the nationalized oil company that's been a slush fund for the pre-ruling party in Mexico forever? Is that what's going on? Yes, we are
just seeing the beginning of it. Just today, 36 people were indicted, including former executive directors of Petrobras, the directors, senior executives of construction companies that were suppliers of goods and services to Petrobras. There were cartel type of businesses being formed there. And this is just the beginning. Actually, we know for a fact that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice in the United States are also looking into the case, because Petrobras is a publicly traded company in the New York stock market and in other countries in Europe. And this is huge. This is at the same time an opportunity for a country that has improved itself in the past 3 years as a democracy to face its own demons, because Brazil will not become a modern country, a thriving democracy, if we allow this type of corruption to continue. So I see this episode as an opportunity, as I see the Truth Commission as an opportunity for the country, for a mobilized society, and we have that in Brazil, in democracy, to continue to look for better ways of providing for its own people.
Well, Paulo Sotero, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A pleasure to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Paulo Sotero, who's the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one night.